the field of journalism. Welcome.
Thank you, Ira. It's so interesting to be in this position.
Is this the first time that you've actually been interviewed on air?
No, I have done a couple of interviews on the air. Bill Richardson had me in when he was hosting the Wonderful Roundup and talked about a documentary I had worked on. And then a couple of times a year, I go in and sit down and talk to Del Richards because he has his marvelous little program on 650. And we talk about music. I love old jazz music. And, of course, so does Dal, the big orchestra leader that he is. So I go in and visit with him and talk about music.
Do you think it's harder to be the interviewer or the interviewee?
The interviewee.
Why?
Because it's all about trust, Ira. And with you, it's weird because for all those years that I was hosting the afternoon show, you were the book guy coming in every week and regaling me with stories about these beautiful works that you'd read through and some of the work that you were doing yourself. And so it's strange to sit here and have you ask me questions.
Well, I'll start with a very conventional question. How did you become interested in radio as a career?
That's a good question, actually. I thought when I went off to journalism school that I was going to move to New York and follow rock bands around and write long-form magazine pieces. I really did. That was my goal. I was going to work and write for Rolling Stone magazine. And I got to my interview at Ryerson. So I had applied to Ryerson and Carleton, got accepted at both, went to the interview at Ryerson in Toronto, and sat down with a man named Ross McLean. And he was doing this interview with me, and I was telling him that I was going to head off to New York and have this career. And he said, actually, no. You'll be in broadcast. And I said, no, I won't, actually. I'm a writer. And he said, no, I'm looking forward to hearing what you do on the air. Well, before I even got back to school in September, after deciding to pursue my time at Ryerson, he died. So I never had an opportunity to allow him to see that he was right. But I did go into a first-year radio course. My teacher was Stuart McLean. And the other teacher was Paul McLaughlin, the wonderful interviewing instructor. And totally fell in love with radio, listening to people's voices and listening to what can happen if you ask good questions and ask people to share their stories. And that was it.
And when you finished school, did you start almost immediately with a position at a station?
I did. I was one of the lucky ones. It was even before I finished school. I did my first year at Ryerson, and Stuart tapped me on the shoulder and said, you know what? You should probably go to CBC. And I was thinking, I'm 23 years old. What do I know for CBC? And he said, no, you know, you should call the executive producer in Vancouver, which is where I was from, and ask for work. So I did. I called him. And his name's Kurt Albertson. He said, yes, you can come for 4 days. I have 4 days of work for you. We're wrapping up this program on the air, and you can come and work. And, of course, 4 days became 4 months. I worked all summer. And that led to a job offer. And I said, no, I'm going back to school. And so they said, well, come back and work for us at Christmas. So this was my pattern. I worked in the summer and at Christmas time and then studied at school. Then went off and when News World started, in my last year at university, I worked at News World and then came out of school and had a couple of job offers. Decided not to come home, but to go to Alberta and work as an associate producer. And it was wonderful. I traveled all over the province and did some incredible documentary work and had all kinds of experiences. And then every 6 months, the phone would ring and they would say, would you like to do this job? Would you like to come back? And then finally, a woman named Liz Hughes called me and said, I'm about to offer you the job of your dreams. There's no way you'll be able to say no to this. And it was to return to Vancouver and to do what she called become the heart and soul of the Vancouver Morning Show. It was a writer-broadcaster role. So here's your microphone and your tape recorder. You can go out and just tell stories. And so that's what I did for 7 years.
That's remarkable. But I'm interested in what did you learn out of the classroom from the actual experience of being on air and of being a writer-producer? Or was it an extension of what you had been taught?
I think it was an extension of what I'd been taught, but, you know, it's that whole tension between theory and practice. So it's one thing to think conceptually about what a question can do. it's quite another thing to go out and ask questions and understand that it's not just the way you ask questions. It's how you listen to the answers, how you follow up on the questions, how you use tone of voice, how you use volume, how you make choices around pace, how you use your body to encourage or discourage a particular response that you're getting, how you can use your eyes to offer clues to people about what you're looking for from them, and how you have an opportunity to sort of go out in the world and explore it in a way that is very sensory, and then come back to the station and sort of apply all that knowledge that you learned in school to make decisions around editing and things to be able to then turn around and share your story.
So all these things you've just described certainly would connect with a sort of creativity, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. So creative.
And it's conveyed on air, isn't it? I mean, you talk about body language, eyes. I'm thinking not just going out and recording people, but in the studio. Do you feel that sort of your physical being on a particular afternoon is something that's projected?
I think so. Radio, I believe, is a couple of things. It's the most visual of all mediums. Television, images move, they're there, but you're always aware that there's a scaffolding around the images that you're taking in. You are distanced from the image. You're sitting there watching it through a box or through a computer, whatever. Radio, it's invisible. It goes right into your head, but the pictures start to come alive in your own imagination. So everything you do in a radio setting influences the way other people understand and listen and hear and respond and all of that. So in an interview setting, yes, if I kind of come in and I'm in a mood or I have a particular energy or I am focused on something different, then that can have an absolute impact, not only on the person I'm having a conversation with or the material I'm introducing, but certainly on the experience that the audience has in listening and in processing it. So there's an intimacy to it that I think as a young journalist I was not aware of so much. But as I listen now and as I work with students to try to help them understand audio, I talk to them a lot about intimacy and the fact that there's an invisibility and there's a closeness, a proximity to not only the subjects and the ideas, but to the people that you're dealing with that has an effect on the way that your stories are heard and understood.
Okay. I think at this moment, though, we'll just take a brief pause for several announcements. Welcome back to UBC Arts on the Air with Catherine Gretzinger. So I'm interested in the role of the producer or studio director. Do you listen, and I'll overuse the word obey, or as host, and I'm thinking of a host, do you have a certain kind of freedom? Now, I'm even thinking of something as pedestrian as the amount of time, say, allotted for a particular interview. It's an important topic, a topic of the day. You have a source. Producer says you have 6 minutes, and you say, I really think this is a 12-minute interview. Do you have such freedom?
You do. I think so. And it's earned freedom. I think that one of the things that a lot of people don't understand early on when they become hosts is that there's power to becoming a host because you do get the last word, full stop, you do. But there's also an enormous amount of responsibility. So every second that goes by, you're making choices about and making decisions for your audience. So it's a negotiation with your producers for sure. I've been so blessed. I've worked with some incredible producers over the years, really, truly incredible. And the studio director, a man named Chris Robinson, who you know very well. So the most outrageous, boisterous, sometimes belligerent person that would sort of behave in this most ridiculous way, but had a heart of gold. And I knew every single day going into that studio that no matter what, he would have my back, no matter what. And he allowed me to learn how to find my voice on the air, because it's a very different thing that happens when you're out reporting. You go out, you collect material, you're always on somebody else's turf. And then you come back and you sort of cut it down and distill it into a story and polish it all up and then present it. When you're a host, people come into your space. So suddenly you have this power, which for me was very intimidating, very, very difficult. So I had to work both on the intimacy part and on the understanding what my role is part. And somebody like Chris really taught me to do that and to know when to put my foot on the gas and when to take my foot off the gas and when to really push for a deeper answer or when to sort of let something go by and double back to it. All the nuance of having a great conversation, you don't just know it when you walk in and sit in front of a microphone. It's something that you have to work on and pay attention to over the years. That's why it's so hard to teach it, because it really is about human dynamics. And ultimately, it's about listening.
Yes, I certainly agree with you. I think it is, definitely. I think listeners would like to know, what is a day like in the life of a host? Could you take us through a day, including a sign-off? So you come in at X hour. What happens?
Right. Well, I'll talk about the morning show, which is what I most often am doing these days. So the show goes to air at 5:37 a.m. Okay? So the preparation for the program, for me, begins the night before. So the producers are very indulgent. They will send me scripts, and I like to read them after supper, in between hockey games and taking my daughter dancing, you know. So I'll read the scripts, and if there's anything that I want to know more about, they provide background notes and a suggested question line and an introduction. But if there's anything I want to know more about, I'll go and do a bunch of extra research and then sleep on it, so that when the alarm rings at 3:12, I now set my iPhone because it's a little bit more gentle than an alarm at that time in the morning. But 3:12, I get up and I leave the house just after 4 o'clock and drive down to the station. So I'm there for 4:30 and do another hour of preparation and getting ready to go. And then the show goes to air, and it's pretty much you step on the ice and slide for 3 hours. In between, there's weather and traffic and news and all of the stuff of the program. But in the practice of it, you have to really manage your time. So everything runs to the second, of course. The top and bottom of the clock are all automated. So there's no just one more second, folks. No, it doesn't happen like that. You get cut off. So you're managing that. So your brain is split always. One part of you is watching the clock and managing that. And the other part of you is focusing on the presentation of the program. And then when you're doing an interview, focusing on what is the story? What is the focus of this interview? How do I ask questions in a way that's going to draw out the guest, create that comfort and trust, and allow the audience to have this experience? So it's a couple of things. So you do all of that, and then you come off the air. You do promos for the next day's show. You do you record the links, we call them, for a podcast, which is the little bits of material in between to sort of link pieces together. Then you go off and do recordings that may or may not be used for the next day or the day after that. Then you participate in a story meeting that lasts about an hour, where you sort of do a critique of the program that was, and then you talk about stories that will be, and then various other bits of research and things, and then off you go.
Sounds like you need a pillow in the office, I think, to do that.
No time to use a pillow. No, it's a lot of work. So in my context, I did it for many, many years, but in the afternoon. So unlike in the morning where you get up and you can sort of build up a momentum and use all of your energy on the air early, in the afternoon, you actually have to learn how to manage your energy so that your big energy, your performance, as we call it, happens between 3 and 6 in the afternoon. So I'm going to be doing that this week and trying to sort of figure out whether I still have enough energy to do 3 to 6 in the afternoon to push forward an afternoon program. So
that's okay, wonderful. So, but now you find yourself teaching as a member of the faculty of the School of Journalism. How has that experience kind of maybe altered your outlook on broadcasting, and particularly the opportunities for younger people who want to enter this particular field? That is to say, are you, well, I really believe you would be positive and upbeat, but do you really feel there are opportunities for younger people today?
There are, and there always will be, for people who have a great attitude, great work ethic, and lots of ideas. So I think those things are at a premium always. So the industry's changed enormously, but the public broadcaster is strong. There's 43 stations across the country. We still have vibrant network programs. There's all kinds of opportunities, and our students who want to pursue audio get jobs. They get work. I want to be clear. They get work. They don't necessarily get jobs, and sometimes those two things are quite different. What I've learned is that the more that we can teach cross-platform, so our program at UBC here is an integrated program, so we teach them everything from Twitter to work on the web to radio, television, or audio, video, as we call them now, to text, straight-up newspaper typewriting. And I think the future is bright. I believe that democracies require journalism, and it needs to be ethical, and it needs to be practiced, and it needs to be professional. There's all kinds of people who can do journalism, but there is such a thing as professional practice. And this has been a great delight for me. I did a lot of training at CBC before sort of starting working at a college and doing a few courses around here to help out when I was doing my master's degree. It has been such a gift to be teaching, because I'm constantly reminded about how lucky I've been, and I'm constantly challenged by the difficulties or the challenges that our students have. So you're constantly thinking about how to help them to navigate through a world that's changed enormously. I mean, I can show you my scars from razor blades, you know, cutting tape. And I see analog tape over here in the corner at CITR, and it just makes me smile to think that I used to lug these huge chunks of gear around with me. I remember going out and interviewing a trapper in Alberta years ago, and I could barely get this machine out of the back of the car to go out there. And now I work on my iPhone. And I teach my students, and they laugh at me, and they say, oh, you can't be that old. And I actually am that old. I am that old. But it's so interesting that we live in this digital environment where everything is possible immediately. The what of the world we now carry in our hands. And so journalism, I think, becomes that much more important, because journalism is about the whys and the hows. So it's interesting and exciting to be teaching it at this time.
So the falling off of radio audiences doesn't really worry you, because if I may ask, you feel that people are accessing audio, but now in different platforms.
Yeah, and in fact, if I look at the public broadcaster, where I still do a lot of work, our numbers have not fallen off. It's really interesting. Not only are we growing sort of across demographic, we're also growing in reach. So we're reaching into communities and out to people who, people might be surprised about that. But absolutely, people are accessing us now in satellite. They're downloading podcasts all the time. But there's a huge uptake in the number of people who are reaching for audio as a storytelling mechanism. And even looking at a traditional newspaper like the Vancouver Sun, they're putting up interviews and web links and things to interviews people have done or to video clips that they're able to pick up. So it's a vibrant and growing part of journalism.
But has there ever been a part of you where really you wanted to try television?
No.
Why?
Because the mechanics of television, in my mind, get in the way of the story. So there's a purity to radio, a simplicity to it that I love. You can't hide behind great pictures. Images can't be distorted in the way that they can in a television way. The whole sort of mechanical process of it, there's so much stuff that is attached to TV storytelling. And radio doesn't require any of that. If we were talking about audiences, the proper television viewing audience is tiny now compared to the radio audience. So I think that if I want to do journalism that's impactful, staying where I'm staying, ironically, you know, because television was the glamour medium, I stayed with sort of the senior service, which is what we always joke about, the CBC on the radio side, the reach is much greater. And the connection with the audience is so much deeper. I can't tell you. I mean, I go in to fill in now a few times a year. And people interchangeably now send me notes to CBC or UBC because they know I'm here. So they know how to find me. But the way that they feel connected, it's very humbling, you know. They really appreciate, deeply appreciate thoughtfulness.
I can understand that, but doesn't that take us all the way back to where we started in this conversation, to the word trust?
Yeah.
Could you elaborate, what do you mean by trust? Is it trust between the host and the audience? It's trust between the host and the interviewee? It's all those things, but it's something more as well, isn't it?
It is. So if you look at journalism as an entity, and you think about what journalism ethics look like, the first pillar of journalism ethics is truth and fairness and accuracy. And I think about that all the time. So it's truth, but it's also accountability, being responsible for your work, and independence. So I'm not doing somebody else's work. I'm doing my own, and I'm standing behind it. And minimizing harm so that I'm not sort of saying things or making suggestions or offering opinions that may hurt somebody. So there's that sort of truth and trust component of things. But it's also a really personal dynamic. If I ask someone if they'll answer my questions, I'm asking them to trust me, whether I'm talking to them about their cat's collar or whether I'm talking to them about a sick child or whether I'm talking to a politician who is being escorted out of office. That's quite the story. But you know what I mean? I'm asking them for that. And they implicit in that is a choice that they have to make of whether or not they want to answer my questions and trust that I'm going to do with those questions something that is respectful of the truth, their truth, that's being represented. And then on the audience side, it's deeply about trust because we have a certain code of ethics, a standards and practices guide that we follow at the public broadcaster. That people who work there follow. And if I broke that in any way by betraying the people I'm interviewing or misconstruing the story or suggesting an outcome that isn't true, then I'm breaking that deep trust that people have. And they do trust. And that is the most important thing to me, where my students will ask me for a reference, Ira, and I'm cautious about it. I'll very often say no. Because I say to them, look, I've worked my whole career to maintain my personal integrity. That matters to me deeply. So I'm not going to sort of sign a blanket reference for everybody. You're going to earn it.
Well, you're teaching me all sorts of things, especially about letters of reference.
So, I've written a letter on your behalf when you won a big teaching award
a few years ago. Okay, well.
And you know, it's interesting because when you're asked to do that, you think about trust. And you think, I don't know Ira as a teacher. He has not been my teacher in that sense. What I know of him is that he comes on time. He cares about his work. He does his research. So you'll sign that note. And that says something too, because your colleagues look to me. And if I misled them, then I'd be betraying that. So trust, yes, it's so important in everything we do in journalism, everything.
Yes, well, you're wonderfully articulate on it. Now, we're running out of time, unfortunately. So my last question is, if you were to write your autobiography, particularly with an emphasis of your life in radio, what would you call it? You have some choices.
My goodness. To listen and listen again.
All right. That sounds wonderful.
I think so.
Okay. I like that very much.
Or keep on listening. I don't know.
Don't change the dial.
Yeah, don't change the dial.
No, I like to listen and to listen again. I think that really expresses who you are and the kind of radio that you not just envision but have practiced.
Yeah, and it is a practice, isn't it? Because it's a craft. We call it a profession because you can practice it professionally. But it is a craft. Every edit is a craft decision, a creativity decision. That's why it's so much fun.
That's why it is so much fun. Catherine, thanks so much for coming and joining us at UBC Arts on Air. It's been a real pleasure.
Ira, you're a gem. Thank you very much for inviting
me. Thank you.
That was UBC Arts on Air, and stay tuned for the amazing Sam Squatch's Hideaway. Don't
say yes if you can't say no. Victim of the system.